So if you're just coming in or came in late, I'm obviously not Tara. My name is La Sarmiento, and I just want to express my deep gratitude to my teacher for giving me this opportunity to be with you all this evening. I just realized the other day that I first walked into this sanctuary 18 years ago, and been with this community ever since. And back then, other than the Buddha sitting next to Tara, I was the only other person of color in the room. So it's nice to see that's changed a bit in the last 18 years. And I was also the youngest person in the room, and I'm no longer that for sure. So I'm an interesting teacher in that teaching is not a passion for me at all. It is a huge practice. I think it stemmed from being traumatized in kindergarten when I got a needs improvement in show and tell. And I've been struggling with that story for a really long time. But people keep inviting me to show up, and I keep practicing. So I don't tend to be someone who writes a Dharma talk. I started writing one and got to a certain point, and my body was just like, you just need to stop that. So what really works for me is actually being able to like feel into the room, see who's here, to feel what the energy's like, and especially after a week like this, right? And so I was sitting in that silence in the last 10 minutes, I realized that it just feels so good to just kind of stop, to not have the internet or Facebook or the newspaper or the news continuing to bombard me with information. And just noticing how in our culture we just have so much of that. It's almost endless unless you literally unplug from it all. And just also getting like how it's become so common, so what we do in our lives, that it doesn't surprise me that, you know, meditation, the practice of mindfulness has become kind of mainstream in that way. We're all seeking this little island of peace in our lives. Now, I came to IMCW 18 years ago. I came to the Dharma after a really bad breakup. How many people here came to the Dharma after a really bad breakup? Yeah, some form of great suffering, right? And I recognized that, you know, the common denominator in all these failed relationships was me. And I really needed to take a really good hard look at who that was. And not to, you know, sort of proselytize, but this practice has really saved my life. I grew up, I came to this country with my parents when I was 10 months old from the Philippines. So I'm an immigrant, but kind of more first generation since I was raised here most of my life. And because my parents were from the Philippines, you know, it was a colonized country. And so I learned about this actually in an odd way. I went to a Filipino dance performance at George Mason several years ago, and it basically did this trip through, you know, what the Philippines was like 500 years ago to the present. And about 500 years ago was when Spain, you know, took over the Philippines, colonized it, and basically stripped it of all its culture in a lot of ways. That's why often when you see sort of an Asian Pacific Islander looking person with a Spanish last name, more than likely they'll be Filipino. And the religion, you know, Catholicism, we're like the largest Catholic country in Asia. Everybody else gets to be Buddhist. there are so many ways that I'm just kind of not enough, you know, in terms of my identities. When I was 5, I realized that I liked other little girls, and I also didn't want to be a little girl. Totally did not identify with that gender identity. And it was a secret that I had to keep to myself for a really long time because it was not at all reflected in the culture. It was not. I had a sense or an intuition at that age that it was not something that was good to be. And so at a very young age, you know, gave myself the story of like, if anyone knew who you really were, you will never be loved and accepted. that there was something innately, inherently wrong with you. So in order to survive, I decided that I needed to be the kindest, most loving, generous, fun-loving person. And that worked for a while, until I recognized that I was suppressing all my anger, all my sadness, all my grief. And I also grew up in a family, when my parents immigrated here, they experienced a lot of racism, and so they refused to teach us their native tongue. Luckily, they didn't withhold the food from us, so we were able to eat well. But I was never taught how to speak Tagalog. And I just sensed that there was a lot of shame about being Filipino, and that my parents' idea of succeeding in this country was to follow the white people. You know, the white people would show you the way to be successful. And don't worry about all these other people. They're not going to get you anywhere. And so for much of my life, I felt very comfortable in all white spaces, including this one. And there was a certain weird sense of specialness to be token. And it really wasn't until about now 10 years ago when IMCW started exploring issues of diversity or lack thereof within the Sangha that I came out as a person of color. And what was amazingly interesting about that was that my white friends within the Sangha, you know, really questioned why we needed to have a separate group for people of color and also LGBTQ people. And, you know, getting things from folks like, oh, well, white's a color, or, you know, my skin's about as dark as you are. It's like, oh, there's a lot of work that needs to happen here. A lot of awareness. It was kind of like, no wonder I didn't want to claim that identity. It's really painful. And so, started these groups. It became really wonderful refuges for folks that were underrepresented in the sanghas, and they're still going strong. And I discovered that after a while, you know, it kind of goes into this concept in Buddhism around no self. And another big thing that I heard often was like, we're all one. You know, why do you need to separate yourselves out? And my question always was, well, who's one are we being? And so rather than identifying as a Buddhist, I've now discovered that I'd rather be identified as a questioning Buddhist. Because there are a lot of, you know, especially around you know, the fact that we pray for all beings, but yet there's a great patriarchy in Buddhist monasteries. So even those of us who practice mindfulness and, you know, greater consciousness can still have blind spots, a lack of understanding, being afraid of what it is that we don't know. So the working title of this talk, because I needed to hand something in to IMCW to do it, was trusting life. And what I found for myself is that it's basically a practice in trusting myself. But how could I trust myself when I thought there was something really wrong with me? You know, something that couldn't be changed, that I had to live with, that this was what was given, and how to survive that. There's something really important about being reflected. And so wherever I am, however I'm teaching, you know, I come out as a Filipino, genderqueer, gender nonconforming, whatever else I am. I have arthritic knees, but I've been very privileged in so many ways in my life, and my parents sacrificed greatly to give me that. But what this practice that I've found is really being honest with oneself, to be really compassionate and loving with oneself in order to be compassionate and loving towards others. And what I became more and more aware of was my own internalized racism, my own internalized homophobia, my own internalized transphobia. And in that is a real purification process of understanding that my own inner self-hatred made it really hard for me to be part of any of these communities. And it also made me aware of how I relied on something outside of myself to give me a sense of belonging. That I relied on people needing to accept me, relied on people being okay with who I was. And what I found is that it caused a lot of suffering for me. And I had this insight when I was on an LGBTQ retreat out at Spirit Rock about 5 years ago, where I realized, like, I kept putting everybody else down. Like, oh, they're not trans like I am, or, like, you know, this, that, and the other. And how we do that, right, to how defensive we get in order to feel better about ourselves. And creating more and more this distance, you know, an expectation that I didn't belong. And so I realized that what really needed to happen was that I could claim my own belonging. That do I love myself enough and am I worthy enough to recognize that wherever I am, I belong. And it's really interesting now. I feel like so many of my identities as a person of color, as a trans person, it's like we're trending now, you know? It's like, wow, you know, it's out there in the media and like around bathrooms, etc. And for me as a child, you know, going into a public restroom was so traumatic. Even to this day, you know, people look twice at me when I walk out of the women's room, you know, to make sure they were going in the right restroom. We're going to parties as a kid, and people always ask me, like, are you a boy or a girl? Are you a boy or a girl? And I just wanted to say that I was both. Whenever I tell people, you know, I don't know how to swim, you know, they kind of chuckle, and it's like, well, you don't know how to swim? You're like 51 years old. Well, do you know what it's like to be born in a body that's not yours and be forced to wear a girl's swimsuit? You never want to go to the pool. So I never learned how to swim. So I share all this with you now, you know, as in this way of, you know, in the wake of what happened in Orlando this past weekend. You can, you know, listen to the news and look on your Facebook feed or whatever, like all the politics of what's going on. And I guess I just wanted to just share a little bit of what it's like to actually be someone that has these experiences. These feelings of inadequacy or not enoughness or shame. I remember a couple years ago I asked Tara if it'd be okay to start on our residential retreats to have all gender bathrooms in the single stalled bathrooms at the retreat center that we had. And she's like, sure, you know, definitely do that. But I felt like rather than just putting those signs up, it was really necessary to like educate people as to why we were all of a sudden doing something like that. And it was probably like the most powerful Dharma talk I gave in 7 minutes, you know, of just sharing that for some of us, you know, being forced into these categories of one or the other just doesn't work. And as we become more and more of an aspiring, welcoming and inclusive community, it really requires a level of willingness and understanding and humility to want to get to know each other. You know, how often do we, you know, just come to this sangha in particular and just like get our hit of dharma and then just walk out? I found over the years that taking refuge in the Buddha, our own innate goodness, also, you know, the historical figure of 2,600 years ago who left us with these teachings on awakening in order to be happier and freer in our lives. And the Dharma, the teachings, life as it's unfolding. And the Sangha, you know, the community of beings that come together to practice. It's been a great help to this, you know, person who grew up feeling like nobody would love or ever accept them. So about a year and a half ago, I decided to go on a month-long retreat. It was my first long retreat. I'm not a big, avid fan of sitting, so it was another big practice for me. And 3 weeks into this meditation retreat, I was feeling so strong, so good, so in love with myself in a good way. When I got a knock on the door of my room. And when you're on a silent retreat, you don't really want to hear a knock on the door. Usually it doesn't mean it's good news. And what I found out was that my mother had a terminal brain tumor, and I decided to go home. And my mother and I never really had a very close or emotional, affectionate relationship. You know, my mother was pretty stoic and strict and intense and a devout Catholic. It's pretty much like 180 degrees from who I was. Yet I went home, and she was in the hospital for about a month, and I would take her dinner every night during the month of April of last year. And my mother always wanted me to, like, continue to be Catholic. You know, she'd always try to slip me a rosary or, you know, ask me if I was going to Mass, and I kept insisting that I, you know, appreciated and still believe in God, but I found something else that really worked for me, and that I was happy with that. And so it really stunned me one day when I was helping her walk down the hallway as she was practicing on her walker to get her strength back, that I said, and we were walking very slowly, and I said, you know, Mom, this is how slowly we walk when we are meditating and do walking meditation. And she turned to me and said, can you teach me how to meditate? And I was like, what did you do with my mother? And so we went back to her room and had her lie down, and I just did a guided body scan and a breath meditation, and she was totally in the zone in like 10 minutes. And a few minutes later, she like abruptly opens her eyes and says, can you please record that for me? I feel very good and relaxed. And I'm like, sure, Mom. And after that, when she started getting stronger, I actually taught her some Qigong. And it was just really beautiful to kind of see how she was beginning to be a little bit more open to my practice. Before that, the only connection my parents had with my meditation practice was helping me count the dana after a retreat. And they were both very funny about that process. I'm also a retreat manager, and they always wondered why some people gave this much and other people gave that much. And it's like, you don't need to know that. It's just keep counting the money. And so my mom was only supposed to live 4 to 6 months. And she surpassed that by 6 months. And when she got diagnosed with a tumor, I had this medical condition that needed surgery as well. And I decided to postpone it because there was no way I was going to, you know, miss 8 weeks of taking care of my mom. And she kept badgering me about, like, you need to, like, get this surgery done before I die. You need to get this surgery done before I die. And I'm like, Mom, you don't understand. Like, I can't take care of you if I do this now. And she, you know, as she started getting sicker towards the end of the year, and after I had my, I had to have the surgery, you know, but she kept surpassing it. I said, you know, Mom, like, why do you think like you've lived this long past your diagnosis? And she said, you know, I prayed to God that I would live to see you through the surgery. And so for my mom, you know, she was never one to like tell me that she loved me all the time. I mean, the first time she told me she loved me was when I came out to her when I was 38. Parents are very conservative, Republican, Fox News watching, Bush loving folks. So you can understand why it took me that long. I had to be financially stable before broke it to them. So, and the first thing, you know, she said was, you know, we've been waiting 18 years for you to say something. So my parents, you know, knew me and loved me way before I really knew and loved myself. And I know that there are so many of my LGBTIQ siblings who are not as fortunate in that respect, because that was my own fear, was being disowned. So my mom, you know, lived 6 months beyond, and in the last like 2 or 3 months, I remember that this practice really helped me to stay with her, you know, to be able to watch her as she lost capacity one by one, be it her not being able to speak, not being able to eat, you know, breathing became labored. And I saw my mom in a different light, you know, through that vulnerability of losing these different capacities. And it really touched me deeply to be able to release her, you know, from her suffering when she finally died. What I'm aware of is I'm feeling pretty disconnected with myself. I think it's a sort of a survival mechanism in a way, where when I'm feeling fear or insecurity or doubt, it's like this kind of moving away. Noticing a sense of concern. And this is, I think, how strong my practice is, and noticing like very little of like, I wonder what they're thinking about me right now. You know, this shooting in Orlando happened on Sunday. It wasn't until actually this morning that I cried about it. I don't know how many other people felt that way, but just this level of numbness that can overtake, making it really difficult to feel or know what one is feeling. And seeing, you know, going to vigils and noticing people around me crying and feeling, and you know, that sense that we have sometimes that when we're comparing ourselves, like, what's wrong with me? Like, why can't I, like, touch into those emotions? Have I gotten so hardened in my heart that I can't feel it anymore? And something that I've really gotten from this practice and from these teachings is that, like, no matter what it is that you're experiencing, it's totally okay. And it's almost like trusting our bodies enough to know how to titrate what to take in and out. It's been a very difficult year. I mean, 2.5 weeks after my mom died, our dog died. And in the middle of my mom's illness in February, a property that I owned burnt to the crisp. And it was amazing to notice, like, you know, even with all these losses, there's this sense of it's going to be okay. So this whole mantra about trusting life, because as we all know, you know, life can throw us some big curveballs, some big monkey wrenches. And I've noticed myself not going into, like, major anger around what's happening right now. What I'm also aware of is, like, I'm not very versed in being angry. Grew up in a home where rage was a pretty regular thing, and vowed to myself that I would never be that way. So it's no wonder we have lifetimes to, like, work all this out, right? And good therapists. Aware that I'm struggling, aware that I'm feeling doubtful, you know, I work with teenagers, and when I first started working with them, I was really afraid of them, and I feel they've been my greatest teachers, because they've actually been some of the most accepting, loving, compassionate beings that I've ever come across. And I was in a pretty intense depression a couple years ago, and I had to lead teach this teen retreat over New Year's, and had to give a talk, and had no idea what to say. And so I told them that I've been really depressed and that I haven't had any energy or ability to think straight, and they just kept cheering me on, you know. And I finally let them just put me on a hot seat, and I just had them ask me questions. And asking for support is not something that comes very easy for me. And what I've discovered through these teens, through this experience of loss of my mom and our dog, and is that there's a lot more love out there than I could have ever imagined. And in a lot of ways, I'm actually kind of feeling that right now. Does anybody want to ask me a question?
And the reason I'm asking is because I guess I'm not a trans person, so the feeling's foreign to me. So could you elaborate about the discomfort you have going to the pool or the bathroom, or the trauma? And if that's too traumatic, then you can answer. The second question is, how do you reconcile that with the Buddhist philosophy of staying with what is? Is that helping you in any way, and so on? And the third question is, do you feel comfortable going to the pool now?
Thank you. So just imagine, like, yourself looking in the mirror and seeing your body as the opposite sex's body. But you're still, like, who you are. But your outsides don't align with how you feel like you are on the inside. And being misgendered, you know, often, like, only in the past, like, 2 or 3 years have I started using the pronouns they, their, and them, because I feel like that encompasses all of who I am. I don't identify as a female, and I don't identify as a male. I feel like I'm somewhere right down the middle. And so, looking the way I look, you know, to me, I look like Allah. I don't look like a female or male to me, but people see me in a certain way, and I go out of my home any day, and half the time people are calling me sir, and half the time they're calling me ma'am, and so it's almost like you're not being seen at all. So the discomfort in not being gotten or understood, and I notice, as you know, I come into this identity of being a transgendered person, it's like I have to come out over and over and over again. You know, I have to correct, you know, people's pronouns for me, or I have to tell people what my pronouns are. And in terms of, like, the Buddhist teaching of accepting what is, I've done that for like 51 years. And what's most recently come clear to me is that really what is what's in my heart, not what is seen by what's outside of myself. Because as you know, another Buddhist teaching is it's all an illusion anyway. So I've, you know, come to terms, and I'm going to be making some changes that I, you know, feel like I'm just going to align myself closer to who I see myself as being. And I don't go to the pool now. Still. I go to the beach, but I don't hang out at the pool. Thank you.
So I have suffered from depression for very long, and I just always, I feel a connection, similarities that you have gone through, and I want to know your take on how to get through them. Because when you hit your lowest point, it's hard to climb back up. So I want to know how you climb back up.
For me, you know, it's surrounding myself with people that love me and accept me and understand me unconditionally, to remind me of actually who I am. You know, in this practice, in these teachings, you know, the first refuge is in the Buddha. And it's really about the premise that we all have innate goodness. We all have Buddha nature within us that's worth loving. Like, you deserve to exist in this world for who you are. And our reliance on anyone else telling us otherwise is theirs and not ours. And so it really is about like cultivating that sense of strength, inner strength, and courage and heart to be able to be with, you know, whatever arises within us. And to be so gentle with yourself and so compassionate towards yourself around that is really key, you know. And what I've found, you know, in working with teenagers is that, you know how, like, it can be so mean to be a teenager and, like, there's all these cliques and all that kind of stuff. And in these retreats that, you know, we offer, it really is like we set this premise, like, we're going to create a world that's not like the one out there. This one is going to be one that's accepting, compassionate, and loving. And if you struggle with any of that, then we're here to, like, help you, you know, so that you can actually, like, know what that feels like in your life. And once you get a taste of it, you just keep going with that. And you keep bringing people around you that help you remind you of that when you can't remember yourself. So I would love to be there for you if you want. And just connect with me after if you like. Thank you for your question.
La, as you spoke, I felt myself drawn into your story more and more. And I felt you making yourself more and more vulnerable. And I couldn't believe it. I couldn't believe that you were exposing yourself right up to the passing of your mom. And you were almost more close to tears than being close to tears, because I found myself close to crying. And I just felt my heart opening up to you. And I realized how much I really love you for making yourself so real to us tonight. I love you.
Thank you, Harriet. If I can just say, you know, when I came to this sangha 18 years ago, you know, most of the people in it were like straight, white, cisgender, middle-aged, highly educated. And it's like, well, what, you know, do I have in common with these folks? And the longer I've been with this community, like the more I fall in love with it, you know. I just have to read you this email that I got from a yogi who's come on several retreats that I've managed and taught over the years. And I haven't seen her in probably like 2 or 3 years. And she just wrote this on Monday. She says, "Hello, La. It's been a very long time since our paths have crossed. Knowing you as I have, I trust that your calling has been keeping you very involved in building community and peace and justice through meditation. I have always admired and respected your focus and exquisite honesty and power. So forgive me if I'm just another email that you need to read. Just wanted to send you my shared sympathy. At this outrageous terrorist attack in Orlando, Florida, it is a blow to all of us in this country and in this world, and for all of us who are working to heal the wounds of life. Dear Law, the tenor of our citizenry has gotten so very polarizing, and this shocks me to the quick. I am so sorry that this has hit us so savagely. Please accept this note as a token of my need to connect with you in the spirit of all we share, and in the spirit of commitment to keep our hearts open as we pause and pray to know how to best move forward. I would be honored to be included in your outreach." And I got several just random emails, you know, from acquaintances, basically. And words can't describe, like, you know, what that means for those of us who identify as LGBTIQ people. For many of us, so much of our lives has been in hiding, in secret. And just want to recognize and acknowledge that, you know, that we stand on so many shoulders of people who have given their lives, you know, so that the young people that are coming up now actually have it a little bit easier. There's still a long way to go, but it's definitely better. And it's been young people that have really inspired me to, like, get closer to who I am in that. Something else I want to share. I have this dear friend, Sebene, who I was in my community Dharma leader training with, who also has a lot of intersectionality in her life with regards to identity. And she wrote this beautiful blog that has this excerpt from it. "Weirdos will slay. because not fitting into any one community is a superpower, but only if you choose to fit into yourself first. Those of us who have spent a childhood and a lifetime having to navigate different communities, groups, identities, languages, cultures, customs, norms, and assumptions, we weirdos, we are very adept and dexterous and resilient as F. We understand and connect with all sorts of people. True liberation doesn't come from changing everything around you to feel comfortable and pleasant and familiar. Good luck with that. Freedom comes from being at ease with whatever and whoever is in front of you. And that starts with cultivating ease with how you are right now. If I can't be with one breath, how can I be with my beautiful, messy life? If I can be with my own complexities and imperfections, I can be with the contradictions and challenges of this mixed-race, mixed-culture world. And I always fit in nature. Feel like you don't fit in? Good. You're right where you need to be. So to speak to what you said is so appreciated. And I think I express and teach from a vulnerability because that is who we are. And, you know, when I start reading suttas and, you know, getting into the studying of Buddhism, like, I get really, like, lost. I don't feel my heart in it. And that might just be my constitution, but we're all different, and it's all beautiful, and it's all necessary. Okay, I'm close to the end. So I'm going to lighten it up just a little bit and sing you a little song to just remind you of how special and important and valid and beautiful all of you are. You're insecure, don't know what for. You'll find your way once you walk through the Dharma door. Don't need ego to cover up. Being the way that you are is enough. Everyone else in the hall can see it. Everyone else but you. Yogi, you light up the world like nobody else. The way that you free your mind undoes overwhelm. And when you smile from your heart, it ain't hard to tell. We all know, oh, that's what makes you beautiful. If only you saw what we could see, you'll understand it's on you to be truly free. Right now's the time to let go so you can believe and thus know. That's what makes you beautiful. That's what makes you beautiful. That's what makes you beautiful. So thank you for your kind, sweet attention, and be who you are.